You are now listening to part two of Origins. The 72nd episode of the Last Bastille podcast resumes now. Justice said, "Well, you know that free speech is not an absolute right." It's just like, oh my gosh, talk about a way of muddying the issue. So anyway, I know I'm going off a little bit on a couple tangents here, but to answer your question, no, I'm not religious, but no, it doesn't matter. But it doesn't matter either, because I take religious liberty seriously. And there's only been one other guy. He was an atheist, because I'm not. He was an atheist, and he, too, sincerely cared about religious liberty, and he dislikes all the humanists, much like I do. Now, again, I'm not saying all the humanists are bad, but it's a nasty trend. And unfortunately, the reason why I say that they're statheists is because many of the humanists do advocate for things like ripping down the Ten Commandments off, like the Alabama Supreme Court House, or saying that Christians aren't allowed to put out nativity scenes and so forth. Because that would be kind of like going to the Jews and saying, you're not allowed to worship Hanukkah, put away the candlesticks. Oh, but if they did that, that would be anti-Semitic, and there would be an uproar, right?
Yeah, the...
why is it okay to oppress... Sorry, but why is it okay to oppress that particular religion, but it's okay, it's not okay to oppress that particular religion, but it is okay to oppress that particular religion? I mean, that's the hypocrisy I have a problem with.
All right, well, moving right along. Why are you so concerned about the abuse of copyright being used as a form of soft censorship?
Totalitarian fascists possess a fetish for black uniformed cops and the concomitant surveillance-ridden police state, which together serve as a kind of automatic chilling effect. Authoritarian communists are comfortable with chipping away at free speech, especially anything they deem to be allegedly hate speech. So where I'm coming from is this. As long as nobody is harmed by slanderous, libelous, or defamatory remarks such as that we see within, which is another reason why I'm against infighting, is because of all the slander, libel, and defamation, then individual free speech and those liberties of the press are never to be erased or stifled from the public record. Because without that public record, we can't have transparency, especially in government. And if we don't know what the government's doing, hell, they can be oppressing people left and right, and you wouldn't know about it. I mean, that's why I write certain articles like the last one I did, which was, in terms of government transparency anyway. That's why I wrote part of the reason I wrote the one on Larry Myers. Because not a lot, even the alternative media refuses to report on his case. So somebody had to freaking do it, and so I did it. Now, fortunately, most of the hard work was done, of course, by Gary Hunt, who acted as next friend for Larry Myers and so forth. So I really dislike copyright, especially in terms of how it's abused, because, and again, I mean, let's go to YouTube again. Hate to rely on it so much, but unfortunately it is relevant to the questions you're asking, because it is an interesting laboratory of sorts. If somebody uses so-called copyrighted music, then even if it's for educational or entertainment purposes that are like nonprofit, which is usually what happens, by the way, then their videos are censored or ripped off or whatever, especially if it's political free speech, which even the United States Supreme Court has adjudicated to be the highest form of free speech, which is that, ironically, which is critical of government.
I was going to say that even violent free speech, political, is defended by the government.
It can be to a certain degree, but you have to be careful even then, because there is the genuine crime of incitement.
Yeah.
And there's also the issue, and I consider this more as a so-called political crime. I don't consider it a crime, though, which is sedition. And I think that's – and you know, earlier when I was mentioned about the cowardice of the Free State Project and other reformist groups that claim they're libertarian, and some are to some degree, just not consistently. They're hypocritical. They another part of the reason too is I think they want to avoid being charged with either committing incitement and or sedition.
Wasn't it Alexander Hamilton that did the Alien and Sedition Acts?
Oh, I'm kind of drawing a blank as far as that goes. But yeah, I think it was more John Adams, if I remember right.
Okay.
But yeah. But yes, I mean, that's kind of its own separate issue, one worth getting into, by the way. But in terms of our situation right now, there is a way we can publicly discuss the use of force, which includes but is not limited to guerrilla warfare, and do it in a way where none of us – We all run a virtually zero risk of any of us being charged with incitement or sedition by any level of government. Now, there are certain things we can't say because it would go into that arena and would be used as evidence against some of us for committing those. But, and I say that because certain very specific circumstances have to be, because I actually read the law. Like, I actually bother to. And I know the circumstances are very limited. So you have to be a really stupid nitwit in order to fulfill all those circumstances, which has to be the basis for them to charge you in the first place. So that's what I mean by the fear of the law, the fear of the – and especially the ignorance of it is used as a political tool by the reformists to thus stifle – our free speech and liberty of the press too, to even mention proper use of force, you know, by us against the government and so forth. But relating to copyright specifically, sorry, I went off on a tangent there too. With regard to copyright, yeah, like if a guy uses, you know, so-called copyrighted, you know, for his, you know, video because it's his hobby or whatever, and then his video gets censored or taken down, even when it's political free speech involved. Let's say like a video about GMO foods, for example. I consider that a form of self-censorship. I mean, again, the whole point about copyright was protecting the profits of the inventor or the artist. But no profits were being harmed in the making of this video, so where's the freaking problem? Well, the problem comes into play when YouTube's corporate rules and terms of service and all that were, I mean, we're kind of getting into mala prohibita territory yet again for the 20 millionth time. The only difference being, though, is that it's being broached as kind of like a breach of contract type issue because YouTube is a, at worst, it's a multinational corporation, not a government entity specifically. So at worst, the assumption that they're going with is that it's kind of, and it's stupid, it's crappy, it's unfair, but that's how they're approaching it, is basically as if it were a contract. But the part that's also wrong about it is that they're also using things like a DMCA, you know, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, as – and again, that thing is a two-edged sword. Can be used for good, can be used for bad. But a lot of ways, the justification for DMCA, or as it is used in the YouTube lingo – DMCAing somebody's video is usually used as a tool of soft censorship that I've noticed, or at least that I'm aware of anyway. So that's why I'm really not a big fan of censorship. You know, again, if somebody commits slander, libel, defamation, or even incitement, the government would add in sedition, but, you know, consider – I really wouldn't worry about it. But you do need to be aware of that, and that's why – it's also the reason, too, I support Creative Commons. I support Creative Commons. I support public domain. I know Gary Hunt, he does common law copyright. which is a version on a theme of all that. Actually, kind of more of a predecessor to the Creative Commons. So, I think that's a better route to go, quite frankly, because copyright, as it is understood in the Constitution, federal Constitution anyway, really only deals with because the assumption is kind of like a fraud or theft of the inventor's potential future profits. But when the alternative media, anyone in the alternative media gets slapped with this form of soft censorship, the reason it is soft censorship is because none of us are infringing on a musician's profit. See, that's the contradiction. That's the sleight of hand that's being used as the establishment to try and censor the freer press as much as possible. So I hope that makes sense.
I think so.
But yeah, in conclusion, that's why I suggest let's just step around it. Let's stay away from copyrighted music especially. And there are Creative Commons music, some very good user-generated music. Actually, I listen to Creative Commons music now because I like the acoustics better. Quite frankly, I like the acoustic and the fact that, because a lot of copyrighted music has vocals and I don't like that particular type of music. Again, that's my personal tastes. But that's where I've gone mainly, is I've just gone away from copyright and copyright music. I mean, you know, what's the name of that? It's that cartel. It's like the Royal, I can't think of the name right offhand. It's like Recording Artists of America or whatever the acronym is. And they very much benefit by copyright. So there is a bit of a corporatist type interest that's kind of involved in this too. I haven't studied it very much, as you can tell, because I couldn't even remember the name. But they've got their own claws in the government. So some of the concerns legitimate, some of it isn't. I just prefer to stay away from it and step around it. And for me, it's worked quite fine. And for a couple other guys that I've counseled to basically stick to Creative Commons material and public domain too, they've been perfectly fine. They haven't been subjected to this type of soft censorship because they've been able to step around the government's tools for doing so. So that was the solution to that problem, at least for the time being.
All right, well, on to the next one. Why do you despise central banking more than taxation, or do you?
Well, let me be absolutely clear. All taxation is theft. So pragmatic, and also beyond that, pragmatically, the government doesn't even require taxes to function, since it has been proven to subsist on a combination of investment dividends, voluntary donations, and assorted fines and fees that they collect, such as from licensure, interestingly enough. So, and some of this can be proven from the comprehensive annual financial reports that nearly every level of government and almost every government agency has some annual report on their finances, which is the real budget. Because remember, government budgets usually are proposed estimates. It's an estimated budget. The CAFRs, like what Deborah Medina mentioned in the gubernatorial debate she took part in between Rick Perry and Kay Baby Hutchinson, when she was trying to get the Texas governorship. And I'm referring to the same thing she did, that's what the government actually spent the money on. So wouldn't it make more sense that if you really care about government spending, you go, you know, this is where the conservatives kind of screw up too, is that they won't actually read the CAFRs, the real budgets. Now, some people have portrayed the CAFRs as, hidden slush funds. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I do think it's important, and I wish more bloggers especially would write about it, because I think we can learn quite a bit that I think would be useful for other purposes. But I think what it comes down to is this. While an abolishment of taxation would necessitate a dramatically less powerful government, I can't think of a better way to – or excuse me, central banking. I'm sorry. Let me say that again. While the abolishment of central banking would necessitate a dramatically less powerful government, I can't think of a better way to keep it small and inoffensive to the sensibilities of the people. You know, if there was anything more dangerous to the future of human liberty than government, it would be the Federal Reserve Bank. It must be abolished forevermore. specie and not flimsy paper or even flimsier computer digits must be reinstated as sound money.
Okay. And do you think that could be accomplished through an economic solution that Gary Hunt proposed?
I think that's one approach that has some viability, but you have to keep in mind, even Gary admitted, that that particular proposal could only possibly take place during the latter stages of the plan for the restoration of constitutional government that he also wrote. His proposed grand strategy.
And so, also probably with the participation of actual economists that are people who are much more experienced in.
Well, I mean, but those people are around right now. We have the Austrian economists. We have, whether they be guys like Mark Thornton or even Lou Rockwell and so forth. I mean, those guys are around right now. The problem is that they have no power. You know, we're in the same position they're in. So that's kind of the issue, is that it's in terms of pragmatically making it happen, because the closest it's come to is reformism. It's all about auditing the Fed.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve has been audited multiple times. I have the CAFRs for the Federal Reserve going back as far as 1995. I don't have the latest ones, though. I need to go back and get the more recent ones, because the last one I was able to get was 2009. So hopefully they haven't stopped doing that. I hope they've been able to be at least transparent and all that. But usually the guys who advocate for auditing the Fed, the only reason they advocate for that kind of intermediate position is because they assume that if they were able to prove that the Federal Reserve has done nasty, awful, is engaged in corruption, which, oh, by the way, has already been proven even by mainstream media, by the way, that therefore that would be a good predecessor to then push forward. And it's totally unnecessary. It's totally unnecessary because what's been openly admitted is more than enough grounds for the United States Congress to abolish the Federal Reserve. The history of the Federal Reserve that's been put together by various scholars is more than enough reason to abolish the Federal Reserve by itself. There is no reason to conduct an audit. But, oh, by the way, they're even wrong on that one, because there's been multiple audits conducted. Now, I know that some guys will also say that, well, yes, there have been audits, but, oh, okay, so you didn't contradict yourself on that one. But let's move on. Well, there were audits, but they weren't good enough. It's like, oh, really? I mean, like, how long, what kind of audit, what is good enough? Seriously, what is good enough to please you? And that's the problem, is that no audit will ever be good enough to please those reformists. This, again, delays. It delays securing our liberty, and it perpetuates tyranny. That's why I don't like reformism. And again, here, same thing with auditing the Fed, which is inherently reformist. No, abolishing the Fed, that's the solution. How you go about it, I think needs to be publicly debated. And I think Gary's economic solution, I think, needs to be part, since it is a good proposal. I think that needs to be part of it, absolutely. But in terms of making it happen pragmatically, constitutional government needs to be restored first. And the reason is because it's become so entrenched. I mean, there are guys who have been trying to put the Federal Reserve Bank out of business, and I don't want to go into detail about it publicly here, but I will say they met their untimely demise, and there's reason for that.
Okay. Why do you emphasize the difference between capitalism and corporatism?
Because they are nothing alike. And because many people, especially so-called progressives, talk as if they were the same. Look, the free market is a freed market, freed from the government's dictatorial intervention. Corporations, especially the multinationals, exist solely as creatures of government, and their concentration of wealth is only possible because they have government permission to privatize gains while also socializing losses at the same time. See, free market, gains and losses are both privatized. And communism is where the gains and losses are socialized. But our current situation losses are socialized. That's why there is a concentration of wealth. That's why there is so-called income inequality you'll hear from the leftists usually. So the reason why the socialists of various stripes and flavors are grossly in error is because they think that, strategically speaking, the solution to this problem is to use big government as a bulwark against big business. Doesn't make any fucking sense. Why should the very entity that created this situation in the first place
and benefits from it so highly?
Right. Well, at least indirectly, sure, with like corporate lobbying and so forth. But why should the very entity that created this situation feel responsible for ultimately solving it? Again, socialists don't understand how they are being manipulated by the Hegelian dialectic. Because if they such is the situation we find ourselves in. Again, go back to the formula, problem, reaction, solution. Problem is multinational corporations are, you know, worker exploitation, environmental destruction, and yada yada yada. And the react and the socialists, their reaction they promulgate is, oh holy crap, the corporations are running roughshod and stealing our stuff and whatever. By virtue of government privilege, though the socialists never say that. What are we going to do? And the solution is government's going to come and save us. More taxation, more regulations. That's the solution. But of course, government created these corporations in the first place because that's what incorporation is. Group of individuals go to the government to basically get for themselves a type of legal shield that prevents them from being accountable to their customers. You know, can the socialists explain to me what part of the legal process of incorporation is actually free market? Can they do that? I would love to hear it. Of course, that's kind of the problem, though. They've never argued it because I suspect they don't have one because it's an indefensible position. Because the joke is that incorporation is at least the way the multinationals use it, is it's completely statist. That's the big joke. So if the socialists want to give it a try, I'd love to hear it. But I don't think they can. And I would seriously suggest they just become libertarians and just, you know, kind of deal with it that way.
Why are you a privacy advocate? Damn, it makes it so hard to figure you out.
Well, this is what happens when you step outside left-right paradigm. Very interesting, and you find out there's a lot more choices than this tiny, tiny box, you know, tyranny option A or tyranny option B. I recognize the yin-yang relationship between free speech and the liberty of the press. There are cultural limits that respect privacy, which I think is fundamental to any sane people. So, in other words, if a citizen's home is not his castle, then what is the point of having a republic? So, and let me kind of explain this a different way too. And I'm talking about exercising here. I'm speaking pragmatically. The more you exercise free speech, and or write something, that's what press is, the less privacy you have. You know, the reciprocal is true too. You can enjoy more privacy if you exercise. You can exercise and enjoy more privacy if you spoke and wrote less. I do view it as a zero sum game between these different liberties. For instance, this very podcast episode, I'm ceding quite a bit of my privacy by exercising free speech and so forth. Now, the reasons I personally do that is because I think it's going to be valuable for other people and so forth. At least that's what I'm betting on. The market will decide, though, whether it's valuable or not. But in terms of me doing this in the first place, yes, I'm ceding quite a bit of my privacy. My best friend, though, is an even much... And she really kind of has a problem whenever I exercise free speech, especially in the alternative media, or even when I go to political meetings, even, and I pipe up and I kind of poke at the reformists and say, hey, what about XYZ thing? And then everyone in the room kind of gets this angry glare at me. It's funny, though. Too bad it wasn't caught on video, but it was good for what it was. But even then, I'm ceding quite a bit of my privacy when I, you know, poke them and, you know, show that they're being hypocrites and so forth. Of course, they'll poke back, like the one, little bit on a tangent. They'll poke back and say and quote Ayn Rand at me, like what happened at that one LP chapter meeting that I've written about, where they said that well, she was basically kind of in favor of the where Ayn Rand was basically in favor of the welfare state, which sounds odd because she's usually known as being against the welfare state. But again, that's the kind of a discussion for another time. But by by virtue of the fact that I opened my mouth, I gave up or I ceded some degree of my privacy. That doesn't mean I've ceded all of it. You know, I mean, there are certain hobbies I do and also certain vices I have I will never, ever mention, even in private conversations, that I do enjoy quite a bit. Some of them I will mention. I'm going to mention I do like to drink now and then. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of the issue. It's all about making choices. And being a privacy advocate is, I said, yeah, if you don't want to talk about certain things that make you uncomfortable, that you think are too private, you know, that's your choice. Again, like I mentioned earlier when you went with your question on religiosity, I don't talk about what my religious beliefs are or lack of religious beliefs. I'm only comfortable with saying I'm secular and I don't pray and I don't go to church. But I'm not comfortable saying anything. You know, that is my right to not talk about those certain things that I'm not comfortable discussing publicly or even sometimes in certain cases even privately. Just as is your right and the guy down the street and so forth. So that's why I'm a privacy advocate. Some people would – some critics may make a point about me being a hypocrite. No, they just don't understand there is a shades of gray here, very much so. And there is a zero-sum game. Now, usually I don't talk about zero-sum games because I really don't believe in – zero sum and apply to many other political aspects. For example, creation of wealth, I think, can be abundant. But when it comes to free speech, press, and privacy, I do think there is a zero sum. More you say, less privacy you have. And if you want to be more private, you should say less things. Again, these are all part of your, you know, natural liberty. But now we're getting into the issue of being pragmatic and when is it wise and not wise. And I think that's a debate worth having. All I'm saying is that I see it as a zero sum. And as a privacy advocate, that's also why one other thing too I want to mention as well that's often ignored in the alternative media is that a lot of the privacy stuff will only focus with regards to digital privacy, especially over the internet. Privacy isn't limited to that, though. You also have to consider the privacy you have in your day-to-day life, offline, you know, the real world, as it were, the forms that you sign, how many times you put your SSN on a form for anything, you know, what do you say in a job interview? That's another big one. And various and sundry other ways, even how to use disguise. There were two book reports I've written that were all about the use of disguises, physical disguises. Has nothing to do with internet privacy, but does have everything to do with individual privacy or privacy in general.
And then along with that, you've written maybe one or two other articles. I don't know if this is the same thing you're just talking about, but how to hide anything anywhere, I think.
It's related. It's a little bit of a different area. But yes, there are some privacy aspects to it. I would say the most important one is obviously if you have a hiding place or you decide to use a hiding place, if you go and blab it about to everybody, again, using free speech, if you use your free speech and blab about your hiding place, how good is your hiding place?
Hey, Sleepy, can you keep a secret?
I like to think I can, sure.
So can
you
I.
Right, right. But that's kind of the issue, isn't it? So, so being a privacy advocate is not so much in terms of like a philosophical position, although there is that too, like I just mentioned. But it's also much more on the pragmatic use of some of your natural liberties and how they interact with one another, and again, kind of like the appropriate, like, and kind of like use of force, I think this would also be something else that should be discussed too. Now, thankfully, more people are more comfortable talking about privacy publicly, and I'm thankful that at least there hasn't been a lot of censorship, whether by the government or by the reformists, against that. So it's not quite as bad as being able to just. But I really would wish the public discourse, especially in the alternative media, got away from the internet. I mean, yeah, I'm not saying ignore it, but I am saying, you know, can we talk about like the forms you fill out, even a thing on physical disguises or two. Now, again, I'm not saying mention anything that's like a trade secret or anything that's like InfoSec sensitive. And for those of you who don't know, InfoSec means information security, such as where your hiding space is. Like that one book talks about you mentioned that I wrote the review on. But I mean, like general concepts, general principles that have already been written about and already are public knowledge. They're just not very well known. I think that needs to be discussed.
I was going to say, you know, I don't think they have any internet over there in Ukraine because all of the people are in the streets.
Sure, but like, but kind of like how you know, you were mentioning to me about the masks that many of the demonstrators were using. Well, that is, they were exercising some degree of privacy.
Yeah.
They didn't want their facial features to be recognized. And hell, since with some of the stuff coming down the pipe with biometric readers and a few other things that the American military has been testing in Iraq, by the way, that some of the really more nasty status want to use here domestically, I think the use of disguise has become a lot more important as time goes on. Now, thankfully, some people are just starting. I've seen some examples in the alternative media where they're starting to get serious a little bit or even just talk about it. But I think this is where the emphasis needs to go. I think we're all kind of – a lot of us are kind of hip to the internet to some degree. We're pretty savvy with it. A lot of us are. There's already plenty of market-based solutions for a lot of it. There is the Prison Break website, you know, but there are options. There are options. So –
You cut off when you said when you're starting to say the Prison Break website or Prison.
Okay, sure. Yeah, well, yeah, kind of like the Prison Break website that does offer some good things and some not, because I've been testing some of that quietly before I write my reviews on some of those programs. But you know, I think it comes down to an issue of emphasis, and I would rather emphasize, and I've tried to do this on my own on the blog, is really just real-world privacy. How do you defeat security cameras? How do you defeat how to use disguises? Definitely a lot of stuff about InfoSec. What do you talk about? What do you not talk about? Some of this also interfaces a little bit with vetting too, like what we were talking about earlier. You know, what do you say when you're meeting up with somebody you haven't? But again, even by virtue of the fact you're even having a meeting with them, shit, and talking about whatever you're talking about politically or otherwise, maybe you're trying to recruit them for something, like a committee of safety, for instance, you are ceding some of your privacy. So this is just something to keep in mind. And I don't want to go too on long about this, but Gary Hunt and I did a two-part episode on privacy as part of the Behind Enemy Lines series. So,
yeah.
You know, people want to learn more about that. We go into gory detail about that. But yeah, that's kind of the short version of why I'm a privacy advocate. It's part of our natural liberty. I think it's important. People are willing to discuss it, thankfully. I just think the focus should be more offline than not. So offline privacy and definitely more discussions about use of force, I think, are two things that really need to be talked about publicly more.
And for the listeners, you can find that at outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. I was going to split this one into two parts. So do you think that not spanking children is a tactic that should be used in conjunction with a multi-generational strategy for achieving liberty? And my second part to this question is, do you think that there is any multi-generational strategy for achieving liberty?
That second part to that question is very good, actually, because no one's asked that. Let me tackle the first one first, because that's something that needs to be critiqued. No, I do not. And neither does Chris Cantwell, for the same reasons. The problem with Stefan Molyneux's proposed strategy here is that he is offsetting the costs for dealing with tyranny onto the next two or three generations. instead of taking responsibility for doing that now, during his lifetime, by trying something, anything, but at least something different from that. Now, as much as I respect Molyneux, his strategy here is about as effective as when Christians attempt to, shall we say, pray the gay away. It sounds good initially to the true believers, but the moment you sit down and just contemplate seriously for a while, I think you would begin to realize there are some serious crippling flaws to the strategy. The only reason libertarians is called Bomb in the Brain, and that Bomb in the Brain series became so popular, despite the fact that the singular study he relied on had serious measurement problems that almost no one has bothered to point out, such as how generally worthy interview questions were. And they were so general, so broad, that it would be very easy for someone to ramp up a high score. And of course, the higher the score, the more it was supposed to mean that the more allegedly abused you were as a child or some such thing. So, you know, they were accepting on faith because Molyneux said so, because he wove this wonderfully sounding narrative that kind of made sense. Not wonderful in terms of the horrible stuff he was talking about, but wonderful in the sense that it was a narrative that made sense initially. But then when you start double checking, and he said, you know, double check it, make sure it's fine, and all that. Double check it, and then a lot of us are critiquing it. And then the true believers then say those of us that are critiquing it are bad. And it's like, oh, okay, so this isn't really about the truth. This isn't really about applying the scientific method of politics. This is about you being emotionally invested in someone who told you something you wanted to hear. And again, Molyneux has a lot of very good contributions. I love his explanation, especially his recent video called The Truth About Slavery. I love some of his, a bunch of his other work. And I've talked to him a couple times when I called in on the Sunday Free Maine Radio listener call-in on multiple occasions. But this is the one and only thing I really disagree with Molyneux about. And I'm willing to criticize him publicly for it, because this is his primary strategy. This is what he's relying on. And all the other tactics, whether it's going to therapy or not spanking your children and finding non-spanking ways of disciplining children and so forth, everything else he promotes revolves around this strategy. So I think, okay, we need to look at the strategy then. To put it another way, you could say that Molyneux's strategy does compete with Gary Hunt's strategy of the Plan for the Restoration of Constitutional Government. And I do think, and I will agree with Dave Ridley, who's a libertarian up in New Hampshire, who's part of the Free State Project, who still has a good head about his shoulder, even though he's a bit of a reformist, unfortunately. I will agree with Dave Ridley that there needs to be competing strategies, and as part of that, competing grand strategies is what I mean, sorry. There needs to be competing grand strategies, and part of that competition involves those of us in the alternative media who have been doing this for a while to talk intelligently and, yes, I will say to a certain degree, politely discuss and debate the merits and demerits of each of these proposed grand strategies, and then let the market decide, the audience decide what they think is best, and then follow accordingly. And because, remember, the market is supposed to be self-correcting. Critiquing someone else's work, I think, is part of that self-correction, or at least an attempt at it. And, you know, even if the critique was unmerited, then that means that the proposed strategy was all the more stronger for it. So you can't really lose either way. You either win by identifying chaff and casting it into the fire, or you identify it as wheat, and then you make bread out of it, to use a metaphor. So, I mean, that's what I think about a multi-generational strategy for liberty by not spanking children. It's inherently bogus because he's casting off his own responsibility for liberty in our lifetime onto liberty maybe sometime in the future for other people. Maybe. And even then, maybe. Because remember, the progeny are going to have to suffer too at the same time. So it's following the same thing that I like earlier when I was criticizing the guys who want to audit the Fed. They're giving more time to the tyrants. I say the same thing here too. Now, I will add this caveat. This particular grand strategy is not reformist. Molyneux is not saying work within the system, thankfully. one of the biggest reasons I love Molyneux. But he is committing the same mistake that reformers do make about, well, let's delay everything until, you know, the apocalypse, and maybe even to delay it a little bit more. I don't think. Look, you have to keep in mind, time is a very important factor in a tyrant's control over a people. If you can control the time that your captive population is spends, you can control them. I mean, what do you think television is? It's a way of controlling time. Because without television, you would spend more time reading and listening, basically doing the stuff I do. Or you would be doing more of the stereotypical survivalist type of stuff, where you would be prepping and, you know, in working harder so that, for at least for a short time, so you can, you know, get a bug out location. You see where I'm going with this. There wouldn't be all the time-wasting stuff. See, time-wasting is a controlling factor that the establishment uses to keep us under their heel. And so that's something very important to keep in mind. Now, with respect to your secondary question, I think I've kind of answered it. No, I don't think so. I don't think there's a I will say this as a caveat. I do think there are backup plans one can have in terms of, if our current efforts fail, then the next generation can just simply look at the immediate next generation can simply look at what we were doing right now, see what we did right, see where we fucked up, and this assumes we're being honest with them. This is why the literature is so important, because that's the record.
Or these podcasts.
Which I consider part of the literature too, in a sense, yeah. Because literature can be something you can define as only written, but you can also define it more broadly as like media in general. But regardless, so the very next generation can see, you know, what we did right, what we screwed up on, and thus, in that way, we can shorten the learning curve for them. Now, no, I'm not saying, well, let's be lazy, stay at home, and read books all day and then do nothing. I'm not saying that. I am saying, let's leave a record behind of what our experiences were, just on the off chance we ultimately screw up and the establishment wins, at least in our lifetimes. And that's why I stress homeschooling so much, because that's how that's going to happen. The carrying over of a genuine culture, a culture of liberty. Which is all actually something I've been wanting to write about is I've noticed a growing trend of more and more children's books coming out that are written by libertarians and even anarchists that are all stories all about how good freedom is and kind of like governments suck. Books like I'm remembering the covers. I'm honestly just not remembering the titles right now, but there's at least four that I found. One of them is explicitly anarchistic. The other three are more subtle and usually more purely libertarian. But I'm noticing the trend, and I'm very, very excited about it. So, and I think that's something that should be stressed. But again, the whole thing about homeschooling and passing on the culture and so forth to the next generation needs to be done anyway. Even if we do win in our lifetime, even if Gary's plan works in our lifetime, we still need to be homeschooling the children and all that. So that doesn't change. All I'm saying is that as a fallback, just in case they dropped a nuke, I'm saying hypothetically, like they dropped a nuke like on the entire United States or something, okay? I'm being a little bit facetious, but just go with me here. The fallback position would be, you know, the homeschooled libertarian children who are living in Nicaragua or something could have a starting point to rebuild, kind of. Again, I'm being a little bit facetious, but I hope that kind of gets across what I'm trying to convey here. Maybe I'm not expressing it the best way, but I view that more as a fallback position, not as the grand strategy we follow. And that's where I disagree with Molyneux. That's where I disagree with anyone else. I haven't found anyone else promoting this. It's really just been him. But that's why I disagree with, well, let's throw it on the next generation and then they'll deal with it. No. No, 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 no. We're the adults. We got to deal with it. If we fail, then yes, the next generation is going to have to, like, you know, succeed where we fail, or at least try to. But again, that's a fallback. That's not, you know, you don't, you know, it's not a strategy for victory of any kind if you promote a fallback position. I hope that's clear to everybody.
I think it should be.
Okay, so I think that answers your question. So, and again, well, one other thing I want to mention real quickly, because this does involve the whole so-called peaceful parenting thing, which is a tactic or a class of tactics, much like arguably being a state citizen is a class of tactics. I really don't think it's appropriate in a political context for people to be discussing this publicly. Again, if parents want to have, if like libertarian or not, if parents want to discuss about, oh, should we do a timeout or maybe we should spank or whatever, that's in their own circles. And I think that needs to be judged on those own merits. I don't think it's appropriate in a political context, because when you broach it in politics, which for me, I define politics as being very, very broad political issues of any kind, even in the judicial branch. So I'm not talking about elections, and I don't limit it to elections either. I mean, wherever there's government, there's politics, is how I kind of think of politics as. I don't think it's very appropriate as a political issue, because then you're kind of, I don't want to say imply, but you're more inferring that maybe, like, maybe a CPS type agency should be involved or not. Like, there's all these other issues that too, or issues of child custody and certain abuses that some types of advocates have that I'll disagree with them on other things, but that have brought up legitimate issues with bias in, like, child custody cases, for example. So what I'm getting at is this. I really don't think spanking is appropriate as a political issue. And the reason and the other problem too is this goes back to Molyneux, because he said, well, if you don't spank your children and enough people over time don't spank their children, then government will just kind of mystically go away. And again, you can critique it on the whole government disappearing part. I'm not critiquing it on that though, because I do think it is possible for government to wither away. I think the problem is the wagging of the finger with never spank your child. You know, it's like, we're getting to shades of gray here. Now, yeah, I think it might be appropriate for some people to have public debates about, you know, for example, if it was, does spanking violate the non-coercion principle? I think that would be appropriate to publicly discuss. And yes, even in a political context. But I really kind of grit my teeth on that one, because I'm starting to think more of spanking more as a vice and not a crime. Unfortunately, the peaceful parenting advocates, they think of spanking as a crime. But unfortunately, when you do that, you're implying that the government needs to get involved, because it's even with a limited government, they have to stop, you know, they have to, they have to punish criminals and so forth. So that's why I'm considering it more of a vice than anything else. It's not great. It's not a good thing, but neither is shooting up heroin. But I don't, that therefore doesn't mean that I think heroin users should be locked up, like how I don't think parents who spank should be locked up. And as time has gone on, I consider it more as a vice. Whether I'm objectively correct or not, I think that's something for the market to decide. But that's how I personally think about the issue. And I have written book reports on at least two books the peaceful parenting advocates have suggested. And I'm going to write a couple more after my upcoming hiatus, because I'm working on a research project of sorts about state citizenship, and that's kind of burning me out. But after I come back from hiatus, I think probably one of the next things I'll work on, more likely than not, is going through the rest of the more important literature regarding peaceful parenting and really seeing what it is. And unfortunately, of the two books I've written reviews on already, they're very statist. Very statist. Especially, what was his name? Strauss, I think it was. Or the one who wrote Beating the Devil Out of Them.
Yeah.
Very statist. He was all, I don't want to go off too much on a tangent, but he was very much in favor of government laws oppressing parents. And I'll just leave it at that, because I wrote about it at length, what he actually said and why I think he's wrong and so forth. But if the peaceful parenting advocates, especially the libertarian ones, are suggesting this kind of crap, you know, I kind of have to raise my eyebrow and just say, okay, what are our principles again? Okay, non-coercion principle and homesteading principle. And like where does the peaceful parenting stuff come into play here? Like, I'm having a serious problem. And I'm not even, and usually the guys who are against peaceful parenting usually tend to be Christians, and I'm not a Christian. So, like, good luck making sense of that. So, again, I would say spanking is more of a vice at worst. At least that's my current thinking as of today.
So now that we've talked about spanking, why don't we talk about why don't you talk about guns more often? Maybe we'll have it.
Because I don't have the technical know-how or skill to blog about it at length. Look, I understand that gun bloggers have been referred to as the propaganda corps of the unorganized militia. And there are Gadsden-style patches that also say as much, by the way, that you can buy. But in order to be a gun blogger, you gotta first have some connections with the firearms industry in order to get your hands on the latest gear, as well as a place that will let you test out that equipment. I have neither. So really the only other thing I could conceivably write about is self-defense more generally, or tactics of self-defense in a very pragmatic application, such like earlier when I mentioned about like the whole traffic stop thing. You know, let's assume it would be wise to use lethal force. Now, how do you go about doing it? That would be an example. But yet, really, how much more detail could I get other than a primer on the basics or postulating hypotheticals, which, if you think about it, I've already done when I wrote my article entitled Serious Self-Defense.
Yeah.
So, I guess in the near future, I guess I could write in much more detail about how to do things like how to cover corners properly and so forth. But really, I think that kind of thing where you're talking about specific techniques and all that, I think that's best taught through unedited video, or better yet, in person, because I think people need to learn those skills in a more visual sense. Like if somebody's covering a corner, you need to learn like why some techniques of covering a corner are wrong because you're exposing yourself and so forth to, you know, potential hostile targets. And why other techniques work better because for the almost opposite reason, because you're minimizing how much of yourself you're exposing yourself to hostile targets and so forth. I think it's more of a visual thing. I really don't know how much I can help, you know, using the pen, as it were, or, you know, technically keyboard.
When you said something about that article, Serious Self-Defense, I remembered the picture on it and that lady putting her hand in that guy's face real nice.
Yeah, and it's an old picture too. And there was no firearm used in that picture. That was self-defense, but no guns were used. And you can also tell by their clothing that's an old picture, nothing recent. So I was trying to convey this is an historical idea. This is going long back in human history.
Yeah, and what that reminded me of is I was going to say for the female listeners in our audience, there's an article that you've written called Heroines of the American Revolution.
Yeah, American Heroines, yes.
Yeah, that's a good article for you ladies.
Well, especially what I wrote about Captain Prudence Wright.
Yeah.
Especially her, particularly.
Yeah, leading her own militia unit.
Yep. And that was Patriots Day, April 19th, 1775. Yeah, if you want to learn more, reread American Heroines.
What is your position on self-defense? I think we've gone over this a little.
Well, it's also good to be precise.
Yeah.
If anyone tries to coerce you into acting like their slave, shoot them quickly. Anyone.
Is there any? Did you like to go any farther on that, or have we already?
I mean, unless you don't care about freedom, then by all means, you know, submit and do what they want. I don't mean to be facetious, but that's the principal position. And again, we can get it now. Probably at a later time would be more appropriate for having debates about when is it wise to and the pragmatic use. But that's the principle. I mean, that's the non-coercion principle in action. If someone is initiating coercion, you stop them forcibly. That's it. Period. Done. End of argument. We don't need to quibble about the morality of it. If we're going to quibble on anything, let's quibble on tactics and techniques, which is what I'm more interested in. But unfortunately, with a lot of these reformists, especially, I can't even get into those issues like covering corner or making the best use of cover too, differences between cover and concealment and so forth. Can't even get into all of that because they think I should just surrender or be captured. That's and in legalese, it's known as being arrested, by the way. But in terms of warfare, it would be surrendering or being captured and just like, oh, I'm just giving myself, no, fuck that. Now, if I choose to, because it's the best option for my survival and I can't win the engagement, then, okay, that's different. That now we're talking pragmatically in terms of actually trying to win. But in terms of morality, in terms of ethics, no, shoot them quickly. Doesn't, you know, I mean, a criminal is a criminal is a criminal. Doesn't matter what excuses they're using for their criminality.
Okay.
So if anyone tries to coerce you into acting like their slave, shoot them quickly.
Well, how come you don't talk about illegal immigration?
Oh, yeah. It's usually the Patriots that bug me on this one. The problem here is not the illegals who scamper across the borders necessarily, but the incentives driving them to do so. While it is true that the Mexican drug cartels need to be forcibly stopped, this is not an appropriate treatment for those who are simply trying to earn a living in order to support their families. If any Mexican nationals, for instance, are to be forcibly deported, it should be those ethnic enclaves like La Raza who have publicly advocated the implementation of the Plan of San Diego. So those who are genuinely seeking political asylum must be willing to assimilate by becoming Americans, part of which requires learning English if they haven't yet done so. Now, I know some of the others of the Patriot faction would insist on more than that. I just insist on English because I do it for more utilitarian reasons. We have to be able to understand each other. Most of the population here does speak English. The laws are written in English. I would say more importantly, culturally, books, you know, the media, if you will, is all in English. You know, don't count certain things like Telemundo or something. But generally speaking, it's all in English. And so even though it's not legally officially language, but even all the legal stuff is all in English too. So whether you're looking at it in terms of the free market or looking at it in terms of the government, the language is basically pretty much universally English. So I insist on that in terms of more utilitarian reasons rather than issues of common heritage or common culture. And I know some of the guys do insist on common heritage and common culture, and that's fine if they want to do that, you know, for their own areas. I don't see it as being particularly useful, though. I know a good chunk of Mexican culture is Catholic. And so technically, at least in terms of how I grew up, I do have that in common with them. And I see no reason why they have to give that up and become a bunch of Protestants, for example. But again, I think the most important thing here to realize about the illegals is that some of it is genuinely criminal. So Mala Insane, that would be the drug cartels and La Raza whenever they are saber rattling for the Plan of San Diego, for instance. But the other portion of it is also Mala Prohibita. And that would be the, let's say, Jose and Maria, who are basically like unofficial political refugees trying to just get by from day to day. And so that, and you see, this is why I don't talk about the illegals, is because the Patriots really don't distinguish here. They consider all of it Mala Insane. They consider morally, they won't say this because they're just going by the law. But morally, they consider the drug cartels, La Raza, and enclaves like La Raza, and individuals and families in the same broad collective brush, and it's not true because the individuals and families, and yeah, some of them will jip the welfare system, some of them will do unscrupulous things, but other ones won't. It's a mixed bag when you get to individuals and specifically families, such as the, you know, there'll be certain snide remarks about, oh, fitting, you know, so many Hispanics or Latinos you know, and in an apartment or something. But, you know, you have to understand they're trying to, you know, get through. They're trying to make it from day to day, much like all the rest of us are. So I just find it rather kind of disingenuous to some degree. I know some of it is also of genuine concern. I know, for example, in the Underwent Banner petition, which I do support and I did file with my Congress critters, that was about a year ago, but there are provisions in there about immigration and put a moratorium on immigration and so forth. And while there are certain aspects of that I do disagree with pretty strongly, I did agree with the majority of that petition and so forth. So, again, I don't want to say it's a complex issue because that sounds condescending. I'm just distinguishing. The drug cartels in La Raza are bad. They're criminal. And the individuals and families, some of them are not great. But there's other ones who are good and they shouldn't be penalized. And I don't think it would be appropriate for them to be, as some have suggested, to have the PNG, persona non grata, tattooed on their arms and all that. I don't think that's fair. If the shoe, and I say it also this way, if the shoe is on the other foot, I know I'd be escaping. If I was Mexican, I know I'd be coming here.
If, well, I don't know. Maybe it's just these four cities or counties down there in Mexico, which is the, and this might be kind of going into just a topic of conversation. So maybe some people, especially our Hispanic listeners, should watch the documentary called Mexican Vigilantes Stand Up Against Crime. And that's, I guess that's all I'll say about that for now.
Sure. And that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, I do support the what are they called? Sorry, I had a second ago. The Zapatistas. I do support the Zapatistas. I think they did and continue to do the right thing. I disagree with their economic positions. But I do think they are right for resisting the Mexican government. In fact, I view them as kind of a spiritual cousin of sorts of the Texans who threw off Santa Anna's despotic rule during the Texas Revolution of 1835 and 36. I do view the Zapatistas as kind of like an offshoot of that in a manner of speaking. Because the Mexican government was corrupt then, it's corrupt now. What is Mexico? It's a narco-trafficking hellhole.
Human trafficking.
And that too. Thank you. I forgot to mention that. And I've studied Mexico in college, okay? And I've also studied various South American countries. Hell, I'd rather live in Colombia before I live in Mexico. And remember, Colombia is the land of the Colombian necktie, for those of you who understand what that is. I really, really don't like the Mexican government, and I understand the proud people of Mexico should be more proud and should resist, stand up, exercise their common right of revolution, and friggin' throw out the tyrants already. But unfortunately, some of them, a good portion of them, lack the will to do so. Some of them are fleeing, which saps their base in order to stage a revolution. Other ones are kind of clueless. Other ones are wannabe tyrants themselves. So they need a clean house. They need to get their own act together. Unfortunately, I don't see that happening anytime soon, even though Mexico, the land Mexico, has approximately triple the natural wealth of the United States because because of all the deposits in the ground. So it's not a lack of funding, it's not a lack, you know, it's every time I hear about Mexican poverty, I just laugh my ass off. Because they would outstrip us here in the States without trying if the free market was actually allowed to work. But they've got too much government. That's kind of the problem, isn't it? Always comes back to that friggin', and it's just kind of sound annoying that way, but it's true. And it's empirically proven, too. That's the worst part, too. It's not just my opinion or conjecture. It's provable. Except it would require many hours of each specific issue to go into gory detail in order to convince your run-of-the-mill statist that they're advocating death, destruction, murder, and ultimately democide. So that's why I don't talk about illegal immigration. A lot of misunderstandings even on our side. And ultimately, in terms of solving the problem, again, it's kind of like central banking. Can't do too much about it until constitutional government's been restored.
Yeah. So I've heard you say before that it is possible for everyone to peacefully coexist. Aren't you simply just trying to advocate for diversity and multiculturalism?
Yeah, I did mention a little bit about peacefully coexisting earlier when you asked me about the Mormons. No.
Hmm.
At least not the establishment's phony version of it.
The one they teach in schools.
Yeah, where they were, as Gary Hunt has correctly pointed out, where the type of diversity where they force everybody to wear the diversity t-shirt. Yeah. By peacefully coexist, what I meant was a population being able to live their lives relatively close to each other without there being social strife or cultural discord. I think that this is more likely than not to occur naturally, so long as government doesn't screw us over as frequently and incessantly as it does. Now, I know many within the Patriot faction, and particularly the friendly National Socialist faction as well, think that only a ethnically homogenous, ironically many different cultures in the Middle East actually peacefully coexist. You just never hear about them because their daily lives aren't deemed newsworthy by the mainstream media cartel. The truth, at least as I see it anyway, is that almost no one knows how to properly use their freedom of association. Whether it be due to social engineering or genuine cultural bias, virtually everyone I've come across really just doesn't, they don't know how to vet and they don't know how to ostracize as appropriate. And that, if anything, the very thing that would solve infighting is also the very same thing that would enable people to peacefully coexist. At least I think so. Because I follow my own advice whenever I can. Obviously, I can't homeschool children because unfortunately, I'm fatherless right now. But of the advice I do give people, I do follow it. And I can tell you for a fact that I peacefully coexist with quite a bit of people, even folks who kind of hate my guts a bit, at least locally here in Austin. And but that's because they know how I am the way I am. And, I treat them with a certain do treat them with the dignity that is owed them and so forth. And thus we get along, even though, if given half a chance, he would love to throw me in a dungeon, unfortunately.
Hmm. So what is your political philosophy? Really? I feel like you've been lying to me. At one moment, you sound like a patriot, but then at other times, you talk about possibly living without any government. Have you made up your mind yet?
Well, I understand the concern there. Because I do get along with the anarchist faction quite well. And some of the other factions, like the Boy Scout faction and even the Christian faction at times and so forth. How do I say this? I'm still trying to make up my mind with regards to some details. I mean, again, as a libertarian, I live by the non-aggression principle, the non-coercion, although it's called that too, the non-coercion principle and the homesteading principle. Those are the two axioms that I do not stray from at all. And actually, it's ridiculously easy. That's the funniest part of all. Sometimes in some moral dilemmas, it might be a little hard actually exercising it. But for me, I don't really have those problems because for me, it just comes, like I said earlier, I've been doing this since I was a little kid, even before I knew there was a label for it, because I knew this was intrinsically right, the morally correct thing to do and ethically sound as well. Like I said, I'm a libertarian. Libertarianism is very broad. Like I said in that recent interview when I was on the podcast, The View from Montana, that's on Blog Talk Radio. But, I mentioned earlier, there was a time before government, state of nature, and then there's government right now. And you could also arguably say, again, like I said earlier, if the anarchists get everything they want, which I don't see happening, there would also be us living post-government. And I don't think that me ignoring that possibility of a civilization without government is somehow bad or otherwise hypocritical on my part. It just means I see the possibility is there. You know, there is something called panarchy, which is basically the political position that is it someone who can perceive both government and, or excuse me, let's put it this way, countries existing with a government and countries existing without a government, and both being able to kind of be side by side, you know, on the same planet, which is, you know, Earth, obviously, and not really have running into any serious problems, either internally or between each other. And I do agree with the panarchist position, absolutely. In fact, you could also say that Gustave de Molinari that I mentioned more at the beginning, you could say arguably had his thesis would arguably be that of a panarchist, that he could see government and non-government coexisting. But here's what I really care about. I care about liberty, and I care about securing it. I do think that indispensably necessary to that is we need to live in a situation without rulers. Now, some people use certain words and they mistake it because they don't understand the etymology of it. And again, this is not something I'm comfortable talking about publicly. I will talk about it privately, though. But a lot of people misunderstand certain words. Again, if we can't even have liberalism, you know, do I really want to go for the even harder cases? But if you look at the harder case words, you know, the verbicide and all that, you know, arguably you could say that the ratification of the Constitution in the late 1780s provided for a situation where a population could peacefully coexist with itself and others in a situation without rulers, yet with representatives. Unfortunately, as our situation has devolved 200 some odd years later to right now, the representatives have become the rulers. And that, I think, is intolerable. So, what I want to be able to secure my liberty, and I think in order to do that, we have to be able to live without rulers. And what that's going to require is genuine tolerance of each other's lifestyles on one hand, and on the other, it's going to require the acceptance of total responsibility for each of our own individual actions and not offsetting the cost to the next generation or putting it off onto other people, you know, whether, you know, by succumbing to balkanization of any flavor. It's accepting total responsibility for what you and you alone do. And I think until time, the Patriots really have a deeply nuanced understanding and appreciation of that, and more importantly, start living freedom instead of quote-unquote fighting for it, but living it so that when it comes down to the actual fighting, and I say fighting is the actual shooting, you know, fisticuffs, that's real fighting, not just arguing, which is kind of what we're doing now, which is all verbal, and that's fine. There's a place and time for everything. But I think more importantly is living freedom, living, being a good role model, I think is more important than pontificating about whether someone else should not spank their children. How about you not spank your children if you believe in it so goddamn much? But that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, this is why I don't like the peaceful parenting advocates all that much, is because many of them don't have children. It's just like, okay, you know, who died and made you the little priest? Then I do agree with that one French philosopher whose name escapes me momentarily, that humanity will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. And I do take that incredibly seriously. But of course, priests aren't limited to just, you know, what you would normally think of priests, like Catholic priests or Buddhist priests or something like that. I would also say, I'm saying more priests here, more in terms of like a propagandist, is what I really mean. So someone who doesn't exercise governmental powers necessarily, I'm talking about somebody who supports it, who has, because that's what statism is. It's political Stockholm syndrome. They love their abuse. They pay the taxes and they use the fiat currency. But it's not like our position where a lot of us do use FRNs because we need to survive. They do it because they think it's good and great and ethically sound because it's the law. Even when it's not the law, it's still the law. I mean, that's the Orwellian aspect of some of those issues. But no, in order to secure our liberty, we have to be able to live without rulers, especially individually, but also at some point in the future, collectively as a people, if we're going to claim we're part of a people, you know, we the people. Well, part of we the people is we have to be able to tolerate each other's lifestyle choices. And yes, our vices are included in that. And until such time that happens, I'm not very optimistic.
And I think three articles that Gary Hunt wrote that are pertain to this are Finding Freedom Again.
Yeah.
Unlike Any Other Government. And We the People, But Who Are We?
Sure. I mean, those can be a useful starting point as well. But again, I'm speaking more like in terms of goals here. I support the restoration of constitutional government because I do think it would, first of all, increase the amount of freedom in our lives first. And second, I think it's also useful because it gets us closer to a situation where we are able to live without rulers, too. So there's that aspect as well. And so in that regard, you know, whenever I've talked to several of my anarchist friends about this, they really shouldn't be bickering with me when it comes to this. And yes, I am addressing them right now. You really shouldn't be bickering me when we talk about in private conversations about this kind of thing. Because many of them are annoyed. Let me put it this way. They're overly concerned. And one of them even wrote about it. Charles Johnson, also known as Rad Geek. And his explanation is the most concise way of explaining it. The anarchists are concerned they're going to get portrayed by the patriots if the patriots are actually successful at restoring constitutional government at all. They think they're going to get betrayed and not be able to get their stateless society, which is what they advocate for. And I've had to tell them over and over and over again, you're just wrong. Because I've talked to the patriots at length about this very concern. And many, not just Gary Hunt, but many of the others have told me over and over and over again, once constitutional government's been restored, they will be more than happy if they can make it happen. They will be more than happy to get some land, set it aside, not make a state of the union, have it be a kind of a free territories, if you will, not under the control of the federal government either. Have it be like a free territory type area, and then the anarchists can move in and have, as the patriots would say, conduct their social experiments. I wouldn't characterize it quite like that, but that's what they told me. The problem is that the anarchists just make assumptions, most of them make assumptions, but don't actually talk with the people that they're actually concerned about betraying them in the future. I, on the other hand, have. So I know exactly what the situation is. And then when I go back to the anarchists and talk to them about it, they're like, la, 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 I'm not listening to you. So I've tried to be diplomatic. I've tried to be an adult about this. But quite frankly, I'm friggin' fed up with their little childish antics. So they can either cowboy up and be responsible, like how they claim, and consider the offer on the table. And if they want to criticize it, then fine, criticize it. But they're not even doing that. They're acting like it was never made. They just want to cover their ears and, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Yeah. That's going to move the cause for liberty forward. Nice one. From a bunch of people who claim they want to live without rulers. Yeah. They claim that, but look what they actually do. Now, fortunately, a minority of the anarchists I have contact with, thankfully, are consistent, are the ones I do talk to very regularly and know about this offer on the table. Or I should say it's an informal offer. It hasn't been like negotiated officially or anything, but that, like in conversations like this, this has come up. And I think it's worth mentioning publicly just to let you know, just like stop being concerned about being betrayed. The friendly factions that Gary Hunt has described need to work to constitutional government, period. End of story. Now, if you don't want to be a part of that, then fine. That's then you choose that, and you've got to accept responsibility for that choice too. But stop, you know, stop blaming me. Stop blaming the Patriots on that, on the whole they're going to betray us later in the future routine. That's a cop out. It's an excuse. You might as well be saying, that might as well be another multi-generational strategy for liberty, is just sit on your own hind end and play computer games all day.
Well, I think all of what we're talking about now ties into the next question, which is, what is your position on revolution?
The Declaration of Independence says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that whenever any form of government becomes just these ends, it is the right of the people to alter, that's the reformism, to alter or abolish it. With abolishing being the more important one, as I would argue. Also, consider that from the Declaration as well, that when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. Absolute despotism. Absolute government, anybody? Under absolute despotism. It is their right. It is their, here's the word, it is their duty to throw off such government. So, oh, let me just get to the next quote. Also, when Henry Thoreau said in his On the Duty of Civil Disobedience that all men recognize the right of revolution, remember, it's a duty. So, oh, we can't have discussions about use of force. Bullshit. Bullshit. You claim to be about freedom and liberty. You claim to support the Declaration of Independence. This is what the friggin' document says. Now tell me how your rhetoric lines up. Yeah, good luck. I'd love to see how they're going to pull some sort of lawyer trick and make that one happen. Yeah. And you know what? You know what? I will quote Ayn Rand them on this one. Contradictions do not exist. It is logically impossible. Check your premises. You will find that one of them is wrong. Yeah, no kidding. Also known as Aristotelian logic. You cannot make, you know, I hate asparagus and I love asparagus. No. You either hate asparagus, the only possibility that exists is either you hate asparagus, you love asparagus, or neither. But it cannot be both. Similarly, you cannot say you're about you cannot say you're about human liberty and advocating for that. You cannot say that you want peaceful coexistence. You cannot say you can't be for any of this stuff and yet be comfortable with soft censorship and wanting to it's not even so much an issue of ostracism. It's more an issue of wanting to play footsie with the government and handhold the government employees and so forth.
A quick thought I had when you were reading about governments are derived, or the consent of the governed is what made me think about this. Mm-hmm. And it made me think that maybe that's why Thomas Jefferson said that every generation needs a revolution.
Well, of course they did.
To secure that consent again. How could the consent span over 200 years?
That's what we'll say. You know, TJ is much more radical than I will ever be. Okay? I'm quite a moderate when it comes to Mr. Jefferson specifically. I will say that. So for those of you listening, especially the Patriots, keep that in mind whenever you're quoting Jefferson and all that. That if I sound a bit too much, Jefferson's way more. It's not even close. It's not even funny. Because I actually read his letters, his actual papers he wrote to people. You know, this is the same guy who wrote a letter. This is a little bit of a tangent, but this is the same guy who wrote a letter to Isaac Tiffany back in, I think it was 1812, I think, or thereabouts, where he said, rightful liberty is action according to our will within the limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. I do not add within the limits of the law, because here's the key part, is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the right of an individual. That's Mr. Jefferson. Look it up. Isaac Tiffany, the letter to Isaac Tiffany, I think it was about 1812 or so. And that was, and because it was the real context of that was that Tiffany had wrote him earlier asking, he was trying to write some sort of schematic thing about how the federal constitution created this federal government thing. And he was asking Jefferson, how do you define, part of what he was asking Jefferson is, how do you define republic? How do you define liberty? That was Jefferson's definition of liberty. Rightful liberty is action according to our will within limits drawn or by the equal rights of others. And then he added the bit about the law, which is funny because Jefferson is a lawyer. He read law. He didn't go to a law school. He read law. He apprenticed. I don't remember his the judge right offhand, but it was another founder, actually, not a lesser known one. That was Mr. Jefferson talking.
That's,
so law's off in the tyrant's will. Hell, I agree to that. Damn, dude.
That's
especially
kind of,
recently.
It's kind of funny how similar the two words biker and lawyer are. It's just someone doing a thing. A biker is a guy that rides a bike. A lawyer is a guy that practices law.
Right, sure. Or attorney. I like, you know, if I'm going to be mean towards lawyers, I try to say attorney or bar attorney. Because obviously there's something called a country lawyer. So-called country lawyer, and those are the guys who read law. I'm okay with that. Reading law, that's fine. I don't particularly would not take that profession up myself, but if someone else wants to read law and become a so-called country lawyer, that's fine. He's not oppressing anybody. He's not justifying a monopoly on the practice of law, at least not that I can see. I don't think that should be licensed. Again, a little bit of a different subject for another time, but yeah, Jefferson was a lawyer, and he was saying law is off under the tyrant's will. When was the last time a patriot wrote or said anything to that effect? Hell, when was the last time an anarchist even said something to that effect? I mean, I think you probably point out maybe William Godwin and a couple of the maybe Spooner made. Well, Spooner, well, can't really say that about Spooner now, can we? He was a constitutional lawyer, and he was an anarchist. So guess he's a bad example. So as much as I like Spooner,
I didn't know that you could. I thought that was oxymoronic and contradictory of being a lawyer and an anarchist.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at. It's also the reason I don't like his essay, No Treason, Constitution of No Authority. I mean, I don't like his reasoning at all. Again, a bit of a tangent, kind of going off subject a little bit. But back to your question, you know, again, part of it is their duty to throw off such government. Do you people not understand? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be annoying or even maybe slightly of a jerk about this, but what the Free State Project did against Chris Cantwell really stuck in my craw, and it wasn't just me either. It was also Josie Wales. It was Larkin Rose. It was a bunch of other people, and even more rank-and-file people that are not known in the alternative media, even obscurely such as myself, but more rank-and-file people who did write Facebook comments or something, and they would say, this censorship is not good, that is practiced by our own side. What gives? This isn't right. In fact, part of the free – actually, a little bit of quick history for some of you folks who are not familiar with FSP. Free State Project up in New Hampshire originally got a lot of their publicity when they would do things like open carry trash pickups. So they were like promoting self-defense, at least in a manner of speaking anyway. So you can say this is a foundational problem. This wasn't just some quibbling like, well, this isn't like the 420 celebrations up in Keene, like I mentioned earlier, where it's like, well, you can smoke or not smoke. It's a vice at best, or excuse me, it's a vice at worst and a medicinal thing at best. So, but you can kind of take it or leave it, but you should still have the freedom to choose and so forth. No, this is foundational. This is going back to the non-coercion principle and how self-defense is necessary for that in order to work, for it to be actually be realized in the actual world, is that you have to take self-defense seriously, and I do. So did Chris Cantwell. So did Larkin Rose and Josie Wales and a bunch of other people. Michael Badnarik, too. So, and I mentioned Badnarik because he used to promote the anymore, and I think I know why.
He used to promote the Free State Project?
Yep, it's in his book. It's like when I wrote the book review of his book, Good to Be King, I think I mentioned it toward the end. I think I criticized him about it a bit for other reasons. I don't think I mentioned Cantwell or the FSP's malfeasance. I don't think so. I may have. I don't remember. But yeah, he said join the Free State Project. And you know, he's, that's nice and fine. Now it's like, whoa, I guess he's backpedaling on that. kind of would have to. Because when he wrote that book, that was like a decade before Free State Project pull their little stunt. But again, this is why I don't join libertarian group or let's say reformist groups and so forth, because they do shit like this. And they're inconsistent. And next thing you know, it becomes the LP one more. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mean to sound like Sam Konkin, but Sam Konkin was right. He was thoroughly right. He, in that speech he gave in 1985 in Los Angeles, which is up on YouTube, type in Samuel Konkin, you'll find it. It's like the only footage we have of him where he's actually like alive, because he died about a decade ago or so, not long after Murray Rothbard died. And Sam Konkin, I was weird. The stuff that I've been concerned about, Sam Konkin had mentioned back in 1985. And he was thoroughly against reformism. Now, keep in mind, he is an anarchist, specifically an agorist. He founded agorism, which is a little bit of a different political philosophy. Different subjects should be dealt with at a different time. But even he didn't like reformism for many of the same reasons I really, really don't.
Now, I think a lot of the topics or a lot of the questions I've asked you have kind of, this one ties into almost all of them. More recently, you appear to become more and more concerned about what you call the evolution of human liberty, especially as it pertains to the evils of the state. What do you mean by the phrase, the evolution of human liberty?
Yeah, this one's kind of ruffled some feathers, and I'm glad it has. All I'm kind of suggesting by that phrase is the following, that over time, human beings have become more and more free. So you look from prehistory to, Middle Ages, the Dark Age, I mean, whatever time period you're going through, but you look at it from earliest records to now. And I personally think that humanity, I'm not talking about Americans now, up until this time, I've been trying to focus more about people on this other nation state or this country. I'm now talking humanity globally. I think over time, humans have become more and more free. Now, granted, in the more so-called Western nations, there's been a much more heavy emphasis on that, and I'm a product of that. But also in some other areas of the world, there's been certain – now, some of it's been manipulated by the multinational corporations. Yes, I know. Don't bother telling me. But there's also other aspects of it where it has genuinely been able to flourish, especially the more isolated they are. There are certain I don't want to call them tribes because that's a little bit condescending, but there are certain free peoples in Asia, on the Asian continent, and even in some areas of the African continent even, where they have been able to stay free of, let's just say the one. They've been able to stay free of government, but they've been able to have a culture, common heritage, common culture, common language too, and they've been able to keep their liberty free. In fact, I recommend for the audience to watch. There are still some episodes that have been managed to not be censored off of YouTube, but if you can watch a variety of series put on by a guy named Ray Mears, who's a Brit. And whether it's Ray Mears, I think one series he did was like World of Survival, and then there was like another one that had survival in the name. He's done a bunch of different survival-related series over the years. There was particularly one episode he did, especially the closing of it, and it really struck a chord with me. And for goodness sakes, I can't remember the name of the episode right offhand or the name of the people that he was covering, because his series was more looking at the indigenous peoples of the world and survive their various climates. How did they survive nature, in this particular area of the world? Sometimes it would be like the Kalahari Bushmen, or other times it would be the Australian Aborigines and so forth. But even the ones that are not as well known, the other indigenous peoples, even the ones I'm currently forgetting right now, how did they survive? And I remember at the end of one of the episodes, he said that these people have retained their liberty all these centuries. And that really struck a chord with me. And they showed the camera footage. You can see the people, they're fine. They're not on welfare. They're not poor either. They're not super wealthy. I mean, they are living outside. Do keep that in mind. but they want for nothing. They waste nothing. They're free. They're not enslaved either. So what's the fucking problem? Why do these people need someone else's civilization? Well, they don't. They have their own civilization. It may not have skyscrapers and automobiles, but they're it's true. They are closer to nature. That's true. But they have their own civilization. They have their own folk tales, mythologies. They have their own customs and so forth. Some of them use the scientific method more than others as they've been able to try and understand it. But just because they don't have laboratories doesn't mean that they're backwards. So this is something to really keep in mind. They're free. They are relatively wealthy, much like how some people would say the bourgeois are. They are relatively wealthy, and most importantly, they are free. In many ways, freer than even you and I are, I would add. They don't need to worry about jaywalking statutes, okay? Which is another Mala Brahmata thing. And they can travel all across the land. They don't have to worry about a fucking cop pulling them over either if they had decided to travel by automobile, because they're out in the boonies. They're outside the cities and even the suburbs and so forth, too. Something else to keep in mind as well. So they've been able to stay free, and other peoples have been able to stay free too. Some of them are more nomadic, other ones aren't. And so, yes, I am speaking anthropologically here. And many of them also, as a little bit of a side note, some of them also enjoy what's been known as polycentric law, which is what I'm also an advocate of, and Molinari to a certain degree too, which has been used in the Middle East and other places on the planet, where you can have overlapping legal jurisdictions, most of which is done by contract, instead of this one hegemonic, singularly imposed, authoritarian, top-down, monopolistic, so-called statutory law, which does have Mala Brahmata and so forth, and also in its current form that you and I are suffering under, really does not respect local government even. Because at least with local government, at least you could always leave the area. In our current situation, you really don't really have that much of an option, really. So over time, even to right now, even in our current situation, as bad as it is, I argue we're still more free than many people in the Dark Ages were, at least in certain areas. But the problem historically, and I have to add this in, this is critical. The last century, I will agree with Molyneux about this because he was a history major. The last century was the worst time in human history, especially in the West, because it was the greatest backslide in the development of human liberty. In fact, it was a de-evolution, and we're still suffering the effects of it even today. Think about it. You had two world wars. You had two world wars. You had the emergence of a central bank here in the States, 1913. That's part of it too. 1946, the Administrative Procedures Act created an unconstitutional fourth branch of government. 1977 here in Texas, same thing happened. So it was about 30 years later. I don't know about the rest of the states of the Union. You folks would have to see where you are, where you live. But I know here in Texas, it was 1977 when they did fourth branch of government here with the administrative agencies. So this last century, the entire 20th century, was just crap. It really was. Now, we can argue and bicker about whether 20th century was worse than, say, 16th century, like in France or something. I think that could be debated, but that's a little bit more scholarly than I really care about. What affects my life, what affects your life, what affects the life of the guy down the street is what happened last century. And it was just statism run amok. It was the rise of statism. One other thing too I need to mention too. The 1930s was the rise of the welfare state, which is with FDR and the New Deal and all that. And we're still suffering. That's where Social Security came from. And we're still suffering under that.
All of it is so new for our generation. Like, because there's some people that were like maybe like 20 or whatever. I don't know.
Well, yeah. So what I'm concerned about is this de-evolution of human liberty brought on by statism, by a belief, a worshiping of big really a worshiping government. I mean, look, if you have a properly limited government, you don't worship it. At best, it's kind of this kind of buck-tooth cousin in the corner you don't really pay attention to. That's a limited government. Let me use another metaphor. You know, government intrinsically is evil. However, the limited government position is that it's always asserted it's a necessary evil. So think of it this way. Think of government intrinsically. Let's not make any distinction between limited and absolute. Let's just say government intrinsically. It's a rabid dog. Okay? It's foaming at the mouth. It's not cute and cuddly. It's foaming at the mouth and it's trying to bite people because that's what rabid dogs do. It's in their brains get screwed up by the disease. And the disease is the lust for power, by the way, metaphorically speaking. That's the lust for power. That's what it is. That's the rabies. And the dog is kind of all the human beings or the government employees. And they're running around. They're trying to bite people. And the biting of the people is the infringement on our liberties. And we're the people running around trying not to get bitten. Okay? It's a rabid dog running around biting people. Okay? That's government. Now, when you have a limited government, what you're doing is that, metaphorically, you're chaining the dog. You're chaining the dog down so you can mitigate how many people it bites and how harshly and how infected the bite. You know, you can kind of see, you can develop it on your own, the metaphor a little bit on your own if you want. And obviously, the chain is the Constitution. Actually, it's any Constitution, really, is supposed to be the chain. The problem in our situation is that the government's broken free of that chain because the chain was too weak. It's fair criticism to make. You know, you don't believe me? Read the anti-federalist papers, and you'll see what I mean.
Which hardly anyone ever talks about, and I kind of wanted to mention really quick.
Sure.
Because my girlfriend bought the Constitution of the United States of America with the Declaration of Independence also, and it's from some company that's probably very statist. And so the first quote they have in here is from Alexander Hamilton, the farmer refuted, that means he's from the Federalist Papers, refuting the Anti-Federalist Papers, and he says, the
Federal Farmer, yeah.
And he says, the sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself and can never be erased. But I think what I get from that is, you know, just live in the moment, you know, don't look back.
Living unconstitutionally, right?
Yeah, live unconstitutionally in the moment. Don't look back at old parchments and musty records.
Well, I think there's also a little bit of admonishment there, too, just to clarify. I mean, Jefferson even mentioned about how you shouldn't give sanctimonious reverence to constitutions because they are constitutions. There is a proper balancing act. Here's all what I'm saying, is that constitutions can be a useful tool in securing our liberty. All I'm saying is, and why I'm not a constitutionalist anymore, is that it's not the only option. Now, yes, I still support restoration of constitutional government without question. That's because that's our best chance right now. But again, getting back to the metaphor, so the chain, the Constitution is the chain on the dog. Rabid dog, excuse me. But the problem is that the Constitution was too weak, and the dog broke free, and now it's back to doing what it was doing before, and it's desperately around biting people. So now we're at a point, you could say a crossroads, although that is a refrain that's, I think, now become a cliche in the alternative media, and you can thank Alex Jones for that one, is we're at a point where we kind of have to revisit this. And basically the two choices as I see it are this. Ultimately, either the rabid dog needs to be chained again, but this time with something stronger. So instead of aluminum, you know, need to chain it with like titanium.
And I was going to expand on your metaphor and say that maybe the chain didn't like necessarily break like by the strength of the rabid dog, but maybe because it was rusted, and that rust could be, you know, public participation.
Or you could say maybe the administrative agencies, the lawyers who of the ABA who actually Administrative Procedures Act that I found out recently and then passed it, much like how the bankers at Jekyll Island drafted the Federal Reserve Act and passed it, did that, would probably be that rusting effect. Sure, I mean, you could say that too. Or excuse me, actually, or the third version we could say is that someone broke the chain, and maybe that was the special interest. Maybe it was the bankers. Maybe it was the lawyers. Maybe both. Who knows? But whichever you want to say, whether the dog broke the chain, whether the chain rusted, like you said, or whether some other force, despotic, came in and broke the chain.
But now we need a new chain made of galvanized steel.
Right. The point is that regardless of how the chain broke, the point is that now we have to make a choice. And the one choice is chaining the dog up again with something stronger, which is what restoration of constitutional government is about, and I think is the very least of what should be done. The other choice is putting the dog out of its misery once and for all.
And I was going to ask, do you think that's anarchism, a stateless society?
I think that's one expression of it. I really don't like the concept of stateless society because, and this may is probably going to tick some people off too, I do not believe in the existence of society. I mean, what is it? Can you go up and like shake its hand? Because that's a common refrain you see in political discourse, don't you? Society was responsible for this guy who flipped out and murdered people. Or this is society's fault. Oh, we need to protect our children. We as a society need to protect our children. I mean, you see these refrains all the time in the mainstream media propaganda. But what is society? Really, what is it?
Well, I could answer that. Maybe not society, but maybe nations, like Gary Hunt wrote in the articles, Nations.
Well, I mean, in a sense that, I mean, look, I try to explain it this way. I mean, I'm a scientist first. I'm an empiricist. I go by evidence. And my principles are all nice and fine. I am a bit of a purist when it comes to that, I'll admit. But I'm also an empiricist as well. And, you know, when I look out in nature, you know, there are trees. Trees exist. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
There are trees. Trees exist. However, what is a forest? Well, it's a collective aggregate of trees. It's a collection of trees. A collective of trees, if you will. Okay, but what's a forest? Can you go up and touch a forest?
Not at once.
No, not even simultaneously either, because it's impossible to do so. You can touch a tree, you can touch the bark, you can touch the leaves, you can jump around from tree to tree like a freaking chipmunk and touch leaves and bark all you want. But you can't do that. Now, some people will kind of confuse the issue and say, well, you can be in the forest.
Well, you're in a group of trees, the ones
yes.
you see immediately.
Thank you. Okay, you get it. Right, because only the trees exist. The forest does not exist. The forest is just a convenient linguistic descriptor for a collective aggregate. That's all it is. This isn't an issue of right and wrong. This is an issue of can you perceive reality, which is a little bit of a concern there. You know, this isn't more of an issue of epistemology. More simply put, how do we know what we know? How does mankind know the things that we know? And so therefore, you know, society, well, wait a minute. I know you exist. You're real. I know I'm real, of course. I know the different strangers milling about around the neighborhood. I know they're real. But yet, are we a society, really? Now, talk about, you know, again, we can talk about common heritage, common culture, common values, even common language and so forth. But technically, when I keep the and the pundits keep pontificating about society must do X, I really have a problem with that. Because, I mean, what is it? What is society? Is it like Godzilla, like a monster, like, douche, 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 I am society, hear me roar. I mean, I'm being facetious, but I hope that gets across the point. Like, what is it? Oh, wait, that's right. There is no society, is there? Epistemologically speaking, there is no society. Now, there are lots and lots and lots of individuals, like on this particular portion of the North American continent, there's about, what, 310 million people? But see, even there, people is a collective word, too. I mean, there's individuals, humans, yes. Some are women, some are men, some have different skin colors, and some have really weird hair, and some of them have not so weird hair. Of course, even the term weird is relative, so let's not even factor that in. There's a variety, is my point. And we're all different. There's some similarities. We speak the same language. Some of us speak it better than others, I'll tell you that much. Yet, we don't really comprise a society. We have there are different cultures, yes. And cultures do exist, very much so. I'm not denying the existence of culture at all. I may disagree with some of them, yes. I don't like goth culture, for instance. Even though I had some friends back in school who were goths. And so forth. But I don't really see this kind of hegemonic society, really. This is also why I don't like the academic discipline of sociology, which is all about studying society. I do like anthropology, though, where you are studying different peoples or different cultures, you know, like cultural anthropology, for instance. Like that, I'm okay with. That's fine. Some of it is ethnically based, by the way, and some of it isn't. But there is no society. At least that's how I see it. I do not believe in the existence of society, and the reason is because, well, primarily, control freaks and bar attorneys and central bankers and other despotic tyrants use society as the excuse for what their little cliques do. So that's why I don't believe in the existence of society. I have an epistemological problem with it, like I described it already with like the whole forest and trees issue, or way of explaining it. And I also don't like it because it's used as an excuse by definable groups of special interests who use it as a mask in order to conduct the tyranny that they engage in regularly. So I hope that makes sense. So, sorry, getting back to your question, the evolution of human liberty is that all of humanity, I think, is gradually becoming freer, very, very slowly. I do think that some move faster than others, both individually and collectively in terms of, you know, aggregates and so forth. I think Americans are freer than, say, people in the Congo. I think that's kind of a duh. Yet at the same time, what really, really concerns me was the events of the last 20th century, especially the more I've been learning about what happened last century and how that affects us today. And so that's why I push more than anything for the, I don't want to say restarting it, but pushing forward that evolution of human liberty, getting back to where we were before the 20th century, and then ideally going much more further than that with more and more freedom. More freedom, the better, as far as I'm concerned. You know, like Victor Hugo said, justice be done, let the heavens fall. I absolutely believe that. And I think the justice in this case is the acquiring, the securing of that liberty. If it can be done by restoration of constitutional government, all more the better. If it can be done by living more consistently without rulers, I'm all for that too. But at this point, what I'm concerned about is securing my own liberty, me personally, and then broadly, in a more political sense, pushing forward the evolution of human liberty. You know, it's moving forward whether I push it forward or not. I mean, it's happening. I mean, that's empirically demonstrable, and that itself would be a kind of an episode unto itself as to why I think that is. But suffice it to say, that's how I see it. The evidence does back me up, at least partially, and that's what I push for. And I think restoration of constitutional government does push for the evolution of human liberty, absolutely.
And the one piece of advice that I could give to people as far as that is that we need to unsegregate ourselves. I know that we all enjoy our privacy, like we talked about earlier. We enjoy being left the hell alone.
Which is a very libertarian thing, by the way. It's a very libertarian trait. Very much laissez-faire, too. Kind of plays into that, yes.
But we need to unsegregate ourselves. And, you know, just like they did to the black and white children before, you drink at this water fountain, you drink at that water fountain. But the way I see it now is that we're all drinking at our own water fountain, including our families, our children, our mothers and fathers. We're all drinking at a different water fountain, and no one talks to each other about what's important.
Yeah, and to kind of clarify that a bit too, I think it's important for each of us who can work together should work together.
Yeah.
And again, you know, there are other, you know, podcasts and other I've recorded and other articles I've written, but you know there are committees of safety. That is a team effort. Or if you want to play it more close to the vest, you know, you can always go form your own security teams. And, you know, there's already material on that as well. So, you know, listen to, I know I interviewed Gary about, that was one episode we did. And I know Gary's written about extensively what his security team did. So that's another option. I know some have tried experimenting with issuing their own currencies, but ever since Bernard von Nuthaus went to prison, that's kind of died down a lot. Although a lot more people are getting more interested in Bitcoin, but that's very experimental. That the value of that's going up and down like nobody's business. And I'm still keeping tabs on that because there might be a possibility if it ever stabilizes, it could be used for some good. But again, even that is more of an individual effort in some respects. So I would say that in terms of collective endeavors, at this point, it's really coming down to security teams and committees of safety. And even the anarchists should be okay with, well, I know they are okay with security teams because you don't need a civil authority. And the anarchists are right on board with that. But they, I would also go even further and say they should also be okay with committees of safety because becoming part of the general association to a committee of safety is voluntary. Well, there is no coercion.
All a committee of safety is like a town hall, a general association. And so I don't understand why that wouldn't be a proper function in the stateless society that the anarchist dream is the committees of safety, because like you got to come together and work together somehow.
Well, and some types of anarchists who are more collective in their focus will stress all day long about worker communes. It's like, well, you know, in many respects, a committee of safety could be a very good corollary to a worker commune in some of its aspects. So again, the security team thing, the anarchists already should be fine with. I mean, that's more like what they would call like an affinity group, but just a more permanent one. Because the affinity groups tend to be more... you see, that's the problem. I understand their own stuff better than they do, which is kind of sad. And one of them even told me that. But I'm going even the next step and kind of pushing the envelope a little bit by even saying even the Committee of Safety. Again, there's no coercion. They're not imposing statutes on you. It is voluntary, so you should have zero problems with it. Committee of Safety does not violate the non-coercion principle, so all libertarians should be okay with that. You know, I'm not really seeing a lot of objections to a COS other than either ignorance, which is something we can work on as part of the alternative media and also in our own individual efforts as well. And then the other end of it is once the ignorance has been overcome, then just simply the kind of more lazy slothfulness, which is kind of rather unfortunate. But that's the other reason why I'm so much against the disinformation and misinformation in the alternative media, because it distracts people from stuff they should be doing that would help them, that the free market can assist in, and gets them distracted about, you know, stuff that doesn't work, that sometimes is reformist and sometimes is just plainly just a bad idea that is just bankrupt. And then when people go try it, they then find out very quickly that, well, geez, I guess taking my video camera and harassing the parking officers in Keene was kind of a bad idea because those guys ended up getting sued. Thankfully, they didn't get thrown in jail. But it's kind of like, you know, really? Like, that's the best you can do? I mean, it was an interesting sideshow, but nobody became more free because of that. And so I give them kudos for originality, but in terms of like a pragmatic, you know, a pragmatic promotion in terms of pushing forward the evolution of human liberty, which they claim to be about. They free Keeners always talk about peaceful coexistence. It seems to have created some strife in Keene. I'm just saying, I'm an outsider looking in, a friendly outsider looking in. I just don't really understand how it helped is really my polite critique of that. So, because if anything is going to get pushed forward in terms of securing our liberty, we got to be able to work together. And I don't see how antagonizing government employees is going to help with that.
So do you have anything else to say in closing?
Sure. We got to grow up. I got to grow up. You got to grow up. Guy down the street needs to grow up. People across the country need to grow up. Need to grow up, be responsible, be adults. be genuinely tolerant of people's lifestyle choices, especially in terms of their vices. And we can be a little bit liberal in terms of, you know, what could be a vice. I'm okay with that. But as long as you don't consider it a crime, then I'm okay. Because once you crime, government gets involved. Don't do that. But be tolerant of each other. Be tolerant of each other, of each other's vices. Learn to distinguish between vices and crimes. Again, Lysander Spooner's vices are not crimes, I stress again. I would also say, and, you know, Gary Hunt mentioned about, he mentioned about moving along the other not-so-thin line. And so I would strongly encourage people to read that and really understand what he was getting at and really start getting to that point of a state of nature, really, I think is kind of a necessary jump-off point. Because then when you're there, you realize that we need to restore constitutional government so we can better be able to secure our liberties. Otherwise, we're just kind of like, and this is going to be a little bit pejorative, but it's true. Otherwise, we would perceive as kind of like isolated outcasts that can easily be picked off. But if there are more of us, then that wouldn't be a problem. Again, it's kind of like in the simplified plan, explanation of the plan for the restoration of constitutional government, like Gary explains, more white dots, then the white dots coalesce. That's what we need right now. But if people are going to spin their wheels about constitutional sheriffs or whatever the latest fad of the week is that I've complained about at length or whatever other version it happens to be, I'm sorry, but did so-called oath-keeping ever keep anybody out of prison? Oh, wait, that's right. No, it hasn't. That's right. Charles Dyer is still in prison, right? Oh, everyone forgot about him, right? But even though he was an oath keeper, right from the beginning of the World War II. Yeah. Oh, but who gives a shit about him? He's a convicted child molester, right? Even though his due process was completely violated from start to finish. And no one wants to release the court transcripts, by the way. Very, very suspicious, but who gives a shit? Who gives a shit about Larry Myers either? Now, fortunately, thanks to Gary Hunt, we were able to get the information out. So thankfully, there isn't like this black hole about what actually happened to him legally. Not, oh, fuck Larry Myers, right? I mean, who cares about him? But that's the problem right there, is a lack of focus, a lack of maturity, and a lack of, I would also say, unfortunately, a lack of sincerity. Until those things have been addressed and fixed on an individual basis, you know, good luck trying to do something as hell, I advise people to close their bank accounts. That's something you can do now that's perfectly legal, doesn't require you to even work with other people, doesn't require a lot of overhead in a lot of ways, but yet is really, really hard. I should know. I've been trying to do that. I'm trying to still get my affairs in order I can do that. Again, like I said earlier, I follow my own advice. Yet, again, think of it this way. I viewed it like a litmus test of sorts. You know, if you're not even willing to close your bank account, how really dedicated are you to the cause of liberty? Say you're against the bankers, say against the Federal Reserve, you're against all these despots. Well, this is one way that you can not be compromised anymore. If the cops can't freeze your assets because they think you're part of a security team, you know, I mean, I think that kind of answers itself. So again, I know that was a little bit long-winded, but it needed to be said. And yes, it's a bit harsh, but some people deserve it, unfortunately. Grow up, mature, take responsibility, be genuinely tolerant, and, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You know, I think a starting point to help move along the other knots of the line, I'll close out on this, is sign that Under One Banner petition. That's an excellent point to start. That's a solid move you can make. Sign that petition, mail it to, you know, your three Congress critters, U.S. senators and U.S. representative. Do that. And then read Second Treatise of Government. And then I would say start studying the law and then seriously consider closing your bank account. See, those are three solid things you can start doing now. That's not even talking about a security team or a committee of safety. I would also suggest you start doing if you've got people around you can work with and who you know is reliable. So I just suggested five things that you guys can start doing right now. But anyway, I hope this was informative. I hope that some of my background, because Maddie, I know people have been asking me about my background, like, and I know some of your other questions, like whether I was a veteran and when did I become a libertarian and so forth. I know people have been asking me questions like that over these past several years. And I would tell people in private conversations, but now I just wanted to just, in one fell swoop, just let's make a podcast about it so I don't have to answer these questions again, just because it's got so repetitive. So I was glad to kind of explain the origins, not just my origins, but also in some respects the origins of, I guess you could say, the liberty movement, even though there's no movement. Really a culture, but that's what we want. We want to secure our liberty, and that's what this is about. Dedicating myself towards.
Well, in closing, I'd like to thank our friend Sleepy Salsa for letting us into his life and his philosophy a little bit. I'd like to thank my friends and family who choose to listen to this podcast. And I'd like to ask of all of you, our friends out there, to help move people along the other not-so-thin line and to work every day towards securing our liberty. I thank you. Have a good night. We'll be right back.